Uh-huh. Great. I'm Laura Hill, here with Mr. Clarence Ingram on June 10th in the University of Rochester's Rare Books and Special Collections. Mr. Ingram, if you could tell me, you came to Rochester in 1953, is that correct?
I came here in 52, really.
In 52. What were the circumstances of your coming to Rochester?
It's a long story. Okay, I'm a native of North Carolina.
Mm-hmm.
And I was I came out of Army in 1946.
Okay.
World War II.
Uh-huh.
And I got together with a bunch of fellows in North Carolina, and we started singing.
I read that.
We called ourselves the Royal Harmony Singers.
Mm-hmm.
We did quite well. We ended up in Philadelphia, living in Philadelphia, and we were... You probably can't remember back that far, but we were on the radio program once a week with Arthur Godfrey,
mm-hmm.
advertising Coca-Cola. In 1949, two of the fellas were drafted in the Korean conflict.
Okay.
So that was the end of it. There were only four of us, so two of us were still left.
Sure.
So one of the fellas came to Rochester, New York. He had an older brother living there.
Mm-hmm.
And so I went to New York City to live. So I was in New York City bumming around, mm-hmm. trying to find myself. Initially, I had just come out of school because I had came out of service and went back to school in Philadelphia.
Mm-hmm.
And I got an undergrad degree in business administration, BBA they called it then, Bachelor of Business Administration.
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't know what I was going to do with it, but I just got a job. So I tried to sell insurance.
Okay.
And starved. So that didn't go very well, so I went to New York City, and I was working for a Corette manufacturing company. And in 1950, the Korean conflict was over.
Mm-hmm.
So the kid that came out of service, when there two came out of service, one went back to North Carolina and went in business. The other one decided he would go up to Rochester, New York, where his brother was. They were brothers.
Mm-hmm.
And they talked the fella in North Carolina to come to Rochester, too, so we can get together. It's a very nice town.
Mm-hmm.
And we do some rehearsing and go back down to New York and make big time. So they talked the fellow from North Carolina to coming to Rochester where they were.
Okay.
Then they should come down and visit me in New York City every month, at least once or twice a month. And they were trying to talk me into coming to Rochester. So one day I decided to do it. So sure enough, January of 1952,
mm-hmm.
I came to Rochester. I've been there ever since. But we never did do anything. We attempted to. But the fellas were young. I was the oldest one of them.
Uh-huh.
And I was only 25.
Right.
And I think they began to discover females.
That'll derail the best they
and,
planned.
And they didn't have time to do any rehearsing.
Mm-hmm.
If they did, it would have to be a short while because they had a date.
Right.
And all that kind of thing. So it never happened.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the fellas that went to North Carolina decided he would leave and go back. So he did. And I stayed there in Rochester. And I've been there since 52.
Okay. Okay.
And
were you, when you came to Rochester, and in the next, 10 to 12 years, were you aware of a civil rights movement happening?
I didn't get that.
Were you aware of a civil rights movement, of civil rights movement activism happening in Rochester?
In 52?
Until 64, what was your understanding of what was happening here?
Well, I knew that Rochester was kind of a, I would say it's a big city,
mm-hmm.
but operating on a small scale, like a small town.
Okay.
during that period, I didn't know very much about Rochester. I wasn't interested in the history of it anyway.
Sure.
But I got a reputation of it. I mean, I got an opinion of it that it was dominated by George Eastman.
Mm-hmm.
And whatever he wanted, so what Lola wants, Lola gets. Well, what George Eastman wanted, he got it. That was his town.
Mm-hmm.
Anything that happened had to get his approval stamped before it could happen. But Rochester had got to be a place that there was no really opportunities in Rochester.
Mm-hmm.
It was no employment. There was a lot of employment, but remedial jobs, you know, just something to do.
Right.
There's no professionals around.
Mm-hmm.
And there were a handful of school teachers, and that's about it. And then during the early 60s, I began to read about the different movements, the freedom marches and
mm-hmm.
sit-ins and all that kind of thing. But I didn't really get involved in them.
Okay.
Now, you asked me about before the riot period. They call it the urban unrest. They don't use the word riots.
That's probably a better term.
But I was in Rochester when it happened in Rochester.
Mm-hmm.
I was very much aware of it.
Mm-hmm.
But it was 2 days of it.
Okay.
On Friday evening, it started accidentally. Saturday, it was planned.
Mm-hmm.
And they implemented it. They got involved in just wreck the place. I guess they called us making a statement.
Well, they made a statement.
They did that.
Mm-hmm.
But Rochester wasn't a bad city, I don't think. My opinion of it wasn't a bad city. But there were certain things, it was the status quo. You did certain things and certain things you didn't do. And I've never been a crusader.
Okay.
You know, to get something started,
mm-hmm.
threaten somebody to make it happen, all that kind of thing. You know, I was able to maneuver around, and I've had a good life in Rochester, really.
What were some of those things that you didn't do in Rochester?
That I didn't do.
You said in Rochester, there's certain things you could do, and there's just certain things you didn't do. What were some of those things that you just didn't do in Rochester?
One of the things, it was hard to get out of your neighborhood into another one, different one.
Okay.
You were isolated. You were at a little spot. It was called the Third Ward.
Mm-hmm.
And you lived there. And if you went into the 11th Ward or the 19th Ward, you had problems.
Mm-hmm.
I can remember, I was very involved in a church.
Which
in
church?
Rochester. The Mount Olivet Baptist Church.
Okay.
And it sounds real funny now. Because the area, the 19th Ward, I would say is 75% black.
Mm-hmm.
But in 1960, just as late as 1960, the church purchased a parsonage in the 19th Ward.
Mm-hmm.
And the day they closed it, there were people passing signs around trying to keep the person from moving in.
Because it was a black church.
Mm-hmm. A black minister.
Mm-hmm.
But the pastor of a white church in the same area discovered it was Mount Olivet Church and his minister and their minister that was moving there. He went around and talked to people to quiet it down. This minister's okay. He's not the run of the mill. You know, he was a Colgate graduate and this kind of thing.
He's a good black minister.
He's a good one.
Mm-hmm.
So it was that kind of thing. That was in 1960. I remember that because I was a trustee at the church.
Okay.
And I was very much involved in it.
Mm-hmm.
And I can remember they had a lot of civil rights cases that were going into court.
Mm-hmm.
You couldn't rent outside of that area. They just didn't rent it to you.
Mm-hmm.
They found all kind of reasons. They wouldn't just blatantly. Then sometimes they would. I can remember, what year was this? in the 60s.
Okay.
I attempted to rent an apartment. And it was, there were blacks in that area,
mm-hmm.
but certain spots there was.
Right.
And the lady, she talked to me on the phone, and I made an appointment. And when I went to see her, she opened the door, but she saw me, and she stood and looked at me and started crying. She told me she could not rent me that apartment. She said she did, all her tenants would move out. And she wouldn't have anybody to buy. She said, why don't you buy it from me? She would like to sell it.
She wanted to sell it to you.
She said, yeah, but she couldn't sell it. She couldn't sell it because it was primarily a white spot.
Mm-hmm.
The white tenants there.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess it was her livelihood. It was about 5 apartments in that building.
Mm-hmm.
And if she rented to blacks, her white tenants were going to move out.
Right.
And it was that kind of a situation, you know.
Right.
And we sat down and talked a long time. I felt sorry for her, really. But it was that kind of quietness. You know, they did things, but they did it quietly.
Mm-hmm.
I know people that personally went to Kodak looking for a job with an application and everything, but it wasn't professional.
Mm-hmm.
But they would say blatantly, like, we don't have any colored jobs. They would tell you that. They mm-hmm. got some jobs, but nothing for you.
Right.
You know, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And there were certain places that you worked when you got into those places that's where they expected you to work. And it was real funny, too, because I went to work for a graphic arts place.
Mm-hmm.
And I stayed there 12 years. And I got to know the director personnel very well. I went there and put an application at that place. I did this for some years ago.
Okay, at Kodak?
No,
or the graphic
this
art
was
place?
A graphic art place.
Okay.
And I met this lady. She was very nice. She said that she felt that I would make a good employee and they could definitely use good employees. But at that moment, she didn't have anything, but she was going to attempt to try to put something together.
Mm-hmm.
And she was going to try to make sure that I got something.
Mm-hmm.
I ran an ad in the paper, you know, seeking employment. And the owner of the company called me up on Sunday night. I was in her office on Friday talking with her.
Okay.
Sunday night, I got a phone call. He invited me over to talk with him the following day, and asked me to talk with. His name was Andrew. He wanted me to talk to Mr. Clifford.
Mm-hmm.
That was his brother.
Mm-hmm.
They owned it. I spent about 3 hours talking with him. He interviewed me, took me around, and introduced me to different people, and offered me a job
mm-hmm.
in Costa County.
Mm-hmm.
And then he said, Clarence, just for the record, will you fill out an application for our files? I told him I had one there. I just filled one out Friday. He said, here? I said, yes. So he called this lady, personnel, check her files and see if she had an application there from Clarence Ingram and then break it down to the office. So she did. But she showed me her eyes got this large. She had just told me Friday afternoon that there's nothing that she had that she could offer me. And then her boss was telling her to bring my application down to his office. Now what happened there? This company hired black people.
Mm-hmm.
But they only put them in certain places.
Right.
They worked in a bindery or shipping, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And when she saw me, I think the only thing was in her mind was, here's a nice black man that's looking for a job. We could use him, but she don't have nothing in shipping, and she didn't have anything for the bindery. So what she tells me, she don't have anything.
Right.
That job that they hired me for in Costa County was there Friday.
But she couldn't offer it to you.
She didn't think about it. It didn't even cross her mind to offer me that job.
Right.
It was that kind of. Mm-hmm. They did it that way. Mm-hmm. Just did the thing that way. And I stayed there 12 years. It was a small company, family-owned company, that had outgrown itself. Very successful. Mm-hmm. But they weren't set up as a company, a corporation. I mean, they were a corporation, but they didn't operate like a corporation. It still was a family-owned business.
Right.
And they decided they got, had need to change some things. So they hired an outside accountant, Stone and Dickman, to come there and look it over. They wanted to set up a cost system. Mm-hmm. So they set up one. Now they got to find someone to implement that system. So I came along and got hired to implement it.
And so does that give you the experience that you need to work with RBOC?
Pardon?
Does that give you the experience that you needed to work with RBOC?
Yes and no.
Okay. Tell me about your experiences with that.
Okay. I worked there 12 years. Mm-hmm. Had a very good relationship with the family owned. Mm-hmm. But I was the only black that ever had a job in the office.
Right.
And when I left after 12 years, they replaced me, but not with another black. But what I was going to say was, when I decided to leave, I had just got married. Mm-hmm. And I decided this wasn't for me. I needed to get something better than this. And I talked with the owners about it. And they understood and they agreed. Mm-hmm. Now, they were very instrumental in helping me find a job.
Okay.
I went to work at Central Trust Bank, mm-hmm. as an internal auditor. I had to go through the management training and all that kind of thing. But in 1970, under Nixon's administration, he called it his New Deal, he called it. Mm-hmm. He set up under the Department of Commerce an agency called OMBE, O-M-B-E, mm-hmm. which was the Office of Minority Business Enterprise.
Okay.
And under the agencies, he set up BDOs, which were Business Development Offices.
Okay.
And BRCs, Business Resource Centers, and scattered them all over the country. Rochester, unique, under the help of George Eastman Cordia Company, they set up their own BDO, Business mm-hmm. Development Office. They call it the Rochester Business Opportunities Corporation.
Okay.
And it was new, not only to them, but it was new to the country. Mm-hmm. But they were doing quite well. They had their own financing. And it was going quite well. When Nixon got his going, he came to Rochester, at least the Department of Commerce did, and looked at what we were doing to get some pointers to what they were going to do.
Okay.
I was doing some work as a consultant with them. They hired me, not for my expertise necessarily, but I could deal with blacks better than they could. I know that's why they did it. But I was working with them off and on. Mm-hmm. And once they got started, the government came in and wanted to become a part of it. So they agreed to let the government come in, and the government run the BRC and the business community in Rochester run the BDO.
Okay.
And I began working for the BDO. Mm-hmm. That's how I left Central Trust and went to work for them, and I stayed there until I retired. That's how I got there. But that was an interesting experience. I learned a lot along the way with that.
I bet.
Because I'd get thrown into things that I went to business leagues, you know, conventions and things all over the country. And the government required us to attend their seminars throughout the year. Mm-hmm. And that's why I said I did some postgraduate work, you might say. I took some courses out here in marketing. Mm-hmm. And I took some at RIT. And I had a good life. I retired after 19 years with them.
Okay. What kinds of projects did you do in Rochester? What kind of businesses opened and operated under RBOC?
When we first started, It was unique. It was rather a riot.
Mm-hmm.
So they decided, when I say the business community, I mean the larger business community, got together and decided that they would set up an agency that could provide financial management and technical assistance to minority businesses in Rochester and Monroe County area. That was the scope of the operation.
Mm-hmm.
The man in the streets now, I'm talking about the brothers.
Uh-huh.
They would say, oh, they're not going to do anything. That's another game they're going to run on you.
Right.
So to prove that they were wrong, everybody came down to the office and wanted some help, they got it. But it was only, we call them mom-and-pop type businesses, only grocery stores,
mm-hmm.
dry cleaners, gas stations, garages, you know, that kind of thing.
Right.
But as they grew into it, then they decided they better expand their effort
mm-hmm.
and establish some business that had some meat in it, something you could get your hand on. The radio station that's going today, that's one of the businesses that got started.
Which radio station?
WDKX.
Okay. Okay.
Locally here.
Uh-huh.
It's number two in the market.
Okay.
So says Abitron.
Mm-hmm.
It's owned by a black guy, Andrew Langston.
Mm-hmm.
That's one of the businesses that got started from RBOC. There was a Rolling Containers Containing Corporation. It was going very well, very mm-hmm. well. There's also a Eltrex Industries.
Now, Eltrex is the outgrowth of Phaidon?
Yes.
Is that correct? Tell me that story. How does that happen?
Okay, during that period, everybody was trying to get something going.
Mm-hmm.
Kodak was doing a lot. Xerox, that's great. Xerox, baby.
Right.
Eltrex got started by Xerox. They called it the Phaidon.
Right.
But they didn't run it like a company. They run it like a social agency. It wasn't a social agency. It's supposed to be a money-making venture.
Mm-hmm.
But they were hiring, supposedly, the unemployable, people that didn't have any skills at all, and training them, you know.
Right.
But they weren't making any money. Who was subsidizing it? Xerox.
Did they never make money with it?
They didn't know.
Okay.
They didn't make any money. They were having a rough time.
Mm-hmm.
And after a while, you know, okay, how good your intentions are, you can have a lot of reasons for doing something, which is good.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're not making any money, those reasons are no good.
Okay. Fair enough.
So, Zurich were having a rough time. That thing was draining them. They were spending money at it, money.
Mm-hmm.
So they decided they should look at expanding it.
Okay.
Running it like a business, getting some professional people to come in and see what could be done. And so this is now, I'm talking about the street talk. Kodak says, I want no parts of it. So we didn't get no glory out of it when you started. Now it's your baby, you run it.
Right.
So they were having a rough time.
Okay.
So the different managers, presidents, or whatever they had would come and they'd stay a while and they would leave because they couldn't do nothing with that thing. So then when our BOC got involved, that's my agency,
mm-hmm.
they looked at it as a business.
Mm-hmm.
We got a lot of expertise from the community. One of my main members on the board of trustees was Dr. Eugene Fram, who was the head of the school of RIT.
Okay.
Marketing school.
Mm-hmm.
They were looking for a person after the last person left there. So they hired the president now, Matt Augustine, he working for Polaroid in Boston, Massachusetts.
Right.
And they brought him to Rochester where after he accepted the job.
Mm-hmm.
But they were broke. They didn't have any money. The fight organization owned it.
Mm-hmm.
They owned 60%, or 59%, 51% or something
mm-hmm.
of the corporation. But they were bankrupt. It was just bad shape. So now RBOC got to go out and find some money to put in it, mm-hmm. to get it going. And you'd be surprised how well the community supported it, supported RBOC. That was their baby. You know, I went out to Kodak and talked with the vice president of, I call it the gift committee. He was in personal relations or something.
Okay.
To try to sell him the idea. He said, listen. He said, Clarence, that might work. He said, let me think about it. Then he called in Ken Harlow, who was another person mm-hmm. with a social background. Mm-hmm. You know, 2 days later, Colette sent me a check for $190,000 and asked me not to cash the check. I could hold on to it, but not to cash it until I got at least another $190,000 from somebody else, because they didn't want it to be a Kodak baby. They wanted to be a community baby.
Right.
But another week later, I talked Xerox. They sent me $75,000. Mm-hmm. Bosch alone gave $50,000, that kind of thing, you know, and we got it together. But the day they went to Kodak, went to fight on then, that fight company, at least I had Matt to do it and talk about buying the controlling interest from Python. They were broke. Mm-hmm. So they offered them, $40,000 for it, and they took it. The company did. Matt offered them $40,000 for the controlling interest of the company.
So who did that $40,000 go to?
Went to the fight organization.
Fight got $40,000 for it.
Matt came to RBOC. RBOC supposedly loaned Matt $40,000. They didn't loan, they gave it to him, but they were supposed to loan, to put in the books as a loan.
Okay.
Matt bought the controlling interest from the fight company.
What year is this?
That must have been 68. I don't remember the exact year.
Okay.
Two weeks after they bought it, they changed their name on it.
Uh-huh. Who's running Fight at that time? Do you know?
Matt was. He was the new president we had brought here from Polaroid.
Not Fight On?
No, not Fight On. Oh, the men...
Who's the president of Fight at that point?
Let me see. Who was the president at that time? Franklin Florence still had a hand in it, but he wasn't the president. Mm-hmm. Bernard Gifford had left. I can't remember.
Raymond Scott? Does that sound right to you?
Yeah, he was still there, too.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
It was something like some kind of way. Yeah, so I'm not a crusader. I didn't get involved
that's
in
okay.
All that.
You're,
all that stuff.
You're a great storyteller.
But anyway, they changed the name on it. Mm-hmm. Now, why did they change the name? If you mention the word fight to any white organization in Rochester, they might throw you out of the window. They didn't want to hear nothing of that.
All right.
So, if they change the name, you forget about the fight organization. You forget about fight. Take a bell trip.
Right. Let's talk a little, if we can, Mr. Ingram, about fight. How does that, to your understanding, how does fight come about? Whose baby is that?
The fight organization was set up by a psychologist, came here from Chicago by the name of Saul Alinsky. Mm-hmm. He sold the idea to the Rochester Council of Churches that he could set up this agency that could work with minorities in Rochester.
Okay.
It's funny about things too. You know, people change all overnight. So he came here and worked and worked. He worked real hard, though. He did a heck of a job. I give him credit for that. Alinsky did. Mm-hmm. And got it organized it and set it up. And they hired Florence.
Okay.
What's Florence's first name?
Franklin.
Huh?
Franklin.
Franklin Florence is the president, first president. Mm-hmm. Now, I've known Frank when he came to the city. He was a minister.
Right.
Very quiet, easygoing guy. Once he became the president of FIGHT, Saul Alinsky trained him, pushed him out there and told him the tactic to use and all this kind of thing. He loved it. He loved that position he had.
Yeah.
And he rubbed everybody wrong.
Okay.
But he got through.
Mm-hmm.
And got over with it. Then when they had after a few years, he lost the president, somebody else took over.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if it was Scott then, or was it Bernard Gifford took over.
Uh-huh.
His whole, he had a turmoil. He fought like crazy to try to hold on to that job.
Okay.
But he didn't. But when it changed, you look at people, how things happen. Even though he was working to promote strengthen the community, the black community, that was, he took fight personally. That was him.
Bernie Gifford did.
Pardon?
Bernie Gifford did.
No, Franklin Florence.
Franklin Florence did, okay.
When he lost the president,
uh-huh.
Now he's a nobody. You don't have nothing to storm up, storm and bark in your office and threaten you and all this kind of thing. So he decided he was going up on Main Street. There was a fella that had set up a Hess gas station there.
Okay.
He decided he got to have something to do, something to keep his name going. So he going to go up there and challenge Hess, coming to the black communities, taking the money, taking it back out of town, you know, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
He stormed into Hess gas station and took Hess on. Hess just sat there and looked at him. Let him go. He went on and on and on. So when he finished, Hess asked him, was he finished? He said, yes. He said, tell you what I'm going to do. I'm going to give you the station. That took him for a loop. He didn't want that station. He wanted to fight.
That's right.
Hess gave them under a few conditions. Number one, if you sell it, you can sell it to anybody that's going to put up a gas station here. As long as you run it, it's yours. And gave it to him. And he run that through the rock. He didn't know how to run a gas station. He didn't know how to. He didn't know anything about business. He went down to the clerk's office and got him a DBA certificate to do business and put some of his church members in their name. Didn't pay any sales tax, didn't do anything. And it got to be a mess.
What happened to it? I've never heard this story.
The state closed him down for not paying this guy. They owed $200,000-$300,000 sales tax. So they closed it off. The guy that put that name on it, at the owners, got stuck with all that money. They owed it to the people. I went down to the state and made an offer to compromise and got them out of it.
Right.
But it was a mess.
But it sounds like a mess.
The station bench got closed. Well, the state closed the station up.
Mm-hmm.
Because we know non-payment of
mm-hmm.
They didn't have anybody on the payroll. They were paying them under the table, so to speak.
Right.
You know, that kind of thing.
Right. Is there a way in which fight was run in a similar fashion?
Pardon?
Was fight run in a similar fashion? Did they have the same kind of financial troubles that this gas
yes.
station
mm-hmm.
did? Tell me about that.
I don't know very much about that because I did not get that involved with it.
Okay.
With it, that really I didn't get involved in it.
Mm-hmm.
Because it was conflict. See, they looked at the RBOC. As a front.
Right.
And I was the general manager. So I was their flunky.
Uh-huh.
So I stayed away from them. I didn't become an integral part of their operation or look at what they were doing or try to talk to me or anything. In fact, the guy that, he got to be a friend of mine, the guy that Frank put his name on that certificate.
Mm-hmm.
I said I'm going to keep my hands off it all. I did for about 5 years, but then I felt sorry for the guy. I do some tax accounting.
Uh-huh.
I went to his house once to do some accounting, and I saw the condition he was living under. The state had everything he had. His wife had thrown him out of the house. He wasn't living with her no more. He had lost the house. He had a rental piece of property that had a fire, and the insurance company paid him, and he took the money and did something else with it. I had a mess, and I said, somebody's got to help the guy out.
Right.
So I did have some connection with the state because I worked with them all along.
Sure.
So I went down and told the sad story. The fellow said, I could tell the story so bad, so sad, when you finish, I felt like crying myself. But it was fun. But I had a good time.
Yeah.
And so the state compromised real good.
Mm-hmm.
And they had garnished, the man worked at one of the corporations here for 40 years. And they garnished his wages, you know.
Right.
To get that money. Took 10% of it, is all they could take. Over 5 years, just took it.
Mm-hmm.
He never could pay that debt off.
Mm-hmm.
So when I went in and talked to the powers to be about it, the revenue officers got real teed about it. But the listening officer, the higher up, said that he agreed that it was harsh treatment, you know, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And he actually compromised for practically nothing and made the state give him almost all that money back.
Wow.
That he had paid.
Wow.
I worked out a real good deal for him.
It sounds like you did.
But it was interesting.
Yeah.
But then I had the community on my side. You know, there were people on that board, that are trustees. If I had tried to operate it like a U of R professor, I wouldn't have gotten anywhere.
How did you operate it?
First of all, you have to create, not businesses necessarily, but you have to create an atmosphere that people want to do business with you.
I see.
And make sure that they did what they were supposed to do. And not just like some shoestring put together, you know, and tied it up
mm-hmm.
and think it's going to work.
Mm-hmm.
But we had some good, some success. We lost a lot of money, though.
Okay.
Wasted it. We didn't lose it. Just wasted it. Because, you know, you don't understand. You learn a lot. People do things, you wonder why they're doing that. We had a client that lost $200,000. And the banker that loaned him the money said to me, said, Clarence, so we have lost that. So one day I got to walk into the committee, loan committee, mm-hmm. and tell them we just lost $200,000. He said, the timing is bad. So he kept putting money in it, knowing that he said, what difference does it make? So we lost the $200,000. So if I give them another 10, they lose it, so what? The timing was, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And when the time was right, he went in and told them they had blown it. Well, nothing they could do with it.
Right.
You know, that kind of thing.
Right.
But I learned from those kind of experiences
mm-hmm.
how the system works.
Right.
If you're going to get anything done, you got to work within the system. You can't take on the system because you're going to lose every time.
It sounds to me like what you're describing is that in many ways, RVOC became a foil to the way FITE was operating in Rochester.
And it was controlled by a board of trustees.
Okay.
And those trustees were not the run-of-the-mill people.
Okay.
You know, they were George Benetti, who was the president and CEO of Rochester Telephone.
Mm-hmm.
There were Howard, there were, this guy named, the president and CEO of our Cybron Corporation. One time the president and CEO of Kodak was on the board. But they made decisions and did things that the average person, no matter how smart you were, couldn't do
mm-hmm.
unless you had some clout.
Right.
We did things through the agency, like certain things you got a nonprofit agency that you're operating. Certain things you can't do. Certain things they call pass-through, but they did them quietly.
Right. Right.
But nobody was going to challenge them.
Mm-hmm.
Which if I had when I lived by myself and did it, they would have thrown me out of the 11th floor window.
Sure. Mr. Ingram, I just want to thank you so much for doing this with us. I would love to chat with you some more, but we're running short on time.
Okay, well, listen, I'm sorry. You know, I didn't make this a priority, truthfully.
No, that's okay.
No, I really, today, when you called, I just got a phone talk with my wife. She was in Rome.
Mm-hmm.
On her way to Frankfurt, Germany.
Okay.
So I couldn't hang up on her.
That's a priority. That's a priority.
So when you called, I just got off the phone.
Uh-huh.
And looked at the time. I said, well, originally I said 6:30, but she said 6 o'clock, we have a little more time.
Right.
So I'm sorry that if I inconvenience you anyway.
Not at all. But I really would love to talk to you again. Would it be possible?
Oh, sure,
to sit
I'm going away tomorrow morning, though.
Uh-huh.
Just for a week.
Okay.
But give me a call.
I will. I'll be back up here in mid-July.
Mid-July.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, just call my house. You got my number now.
I do.
Anytime.
Fantastic.
It would be interesting.
Yeah, I would love to just keep hearing these stories from you. They're fantastic. Thank you so much.
Okay.
Thank you.
How long have you been to university?
Over 30 years.
Do you remember Dr. Jefferson, Fred Jefferson?
Yes, I do.
He's a personal friend of mine.
Yes.
He's the one that told me how to come on up here without any problem. I had problems. I haven't been here in a long time. You go down the way too?
Yes, sir. I'm from Binghamton.
From Binghamton?
Yes.
You know, after I stopped singing, with the Royal Hunters.